Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Sarah Stevens, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of Robert H. Hinckley and the Noble Foundation. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in the government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships here in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to visit our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is The Victory Lab, The Secret Science of Winning Campaigns. And today's guest is Sasha Eisenberg. He is a celebrated journalist and the author of The Victory Lab, which examines the secret science of winning campaigns. He is also currently a Harvard resident scholar. The book, which Politico called Moneyball for Politics, explores the analytical revolution, involving randomized control trials borrowed from academic social sciences and statistical model and data mining techniques inspired by corporate marketing that have upended the practice of 21st century electioneering. So please, join me in welcoming our guest.
Thank you all very much. I know I'm supposed to act like we're all intimidated by the snow, and thank you for coming out and braving it, but it's really not that bad. I was actually disappointed to see how alarmist your local TV is, because it's just as bad as it is on the East Coast, and I sort of expect you guys should be blasé about snow. This book came out last year, right before the 2012 elections, but the sort of the germ of it came out of my experience covering the 2008 campaign. And at the time, I was a reporter for the Boston Globe and was covering candidates largely the way that I think you guys see campaigns as consumers of the media. I spent a lot of time trying to be as close to the candidates I was covering as possible. I spent a lot of time covering McCain, but traveled with Obama and with Hillary during the primaries, and flew on their planes and sat on their buses and went to all their speeches. And every day I basically kept my eyes on the candidate, what he or she was saying, and then tried to use my sort of sources and reporting skills to understand why they were saying it and why they were going the places they were going. And I would talk to the media people to understand why they were putting what they were putting in their ads and try to take stock of what the folks in the press offices were doing to create some little kerfuffle each day over some minor bit of news. Talk to the pollsters about, again, why they were saying what they were saying, why they were going where they were going, who they were trying to address. And at the core of it, I think, is I was trying to answer what is sort of the unspoken question that goes into a lot of media coverage of campaigns, which is sort of, can we identify the one big thing on which this election is going to turn? These are the stories that make page one, the stories that people talk about. You know, can you ahead of time sort of say, this is the issue that's going to make the difference, or this is the state or the county or the media market that's going to prove pivotal, or this is the key strategic decision or the big tactical shift, or here's the moment, the debate or the convention speech on which an election will be decided. And the thing I realized only after that election had ended was how there were a lot of people on the campaign, or there was a lot of campaign that I hadn't been looking at, and that as I focused on the candidates and their staged events and the big sort of media spectacles, the conventions and the debates, and talked to the people on the campaign who were involved in sort of shaping and guiding those, I was missing a whole end of a campaign, much of it taking place at headquarters where there were dozens, if not hundreds, of people, not only whose names I didn't know and whose work I didn't understand, but whose job descriptions I didn't realize even existed in politics. And these were people I will very affectionately lump together as geeks. And not only did they do things that were entirely unrelated to where the candidate went and what the candidate said, or what the ad said, but they would have thought that the whole underlying premise guiding my coverage, that there was sort of one big thing driving an election, was silly. They would have, as a sort of intellectual proposition, the idea that something as complex and messy as a presidential election would pivot on one place or one move or one issue was silly. And the reason that they were able to be so confident in this way of thinking was that their field, the field of campaigns, had been given a sort of pair of innovations from other fields over the decade before that made lots of little things measurable. And as a result, they were able to radically reimagine campaigns, elections, not as about a couple of big things, but as about the intersection, interaction of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of very small interactions that had now become measurable. And so I responded well to learning about this sort of subculture because I had been long since convinced that political campaigns could stand to get smarter. And the reason I thought this was because I covered some of them. I had been a political reporter in Philadelphia earlier in my career, and I, as a reporter, always liked the day after the election because I could call my sources on the campaigns and have a slightly more candid conversation with them than I had before. And so the morning after an election, I would call around, and you'd have sort of two types of conversations. The conversations you'd have with the people who'd been involved in the winning campaign always were more or less the same, which is you ask sort of, so what happened? Why'd you win? And pretty quickly you're hearing about some discrete decision that had been made at some point during the campaign that almost inevitably the person with whom you're talking had been directly involved. And so you talk to the media consultant, you say, so what happened? Why'd you win? And you get this, long story that, it was a week out, and we were down 6 points, and I looked at the polls, and, we were just getting killed with women. So I tore up our media plan for the last week of the race, and we drove the candidate out to this suburban home, and it was a pink house, and we shot him in front of a swing set, and then we drove to the studio, and we all night we spent editing this ad, and took it quickly to all the stations, and took down the ads that we'd bought for the final weekend. Just ran the pink house ad wall to wall, and wouldn't you know it, we pulled even with women, and we won it on election day. I'm like, okay, it's a pretty good story. It seems plausible. And then you talk to the press secretary, and you hear about this one, brilliant zinger that the candidate used in some radio ad or radio debate that you didn't even know existed, but that was really pivotal. And then you talk to the field people, or you talk to the advanced people who schedule the events, and you hear that all of a sudden, 5 weeks out, they decided to stop going to diners and only visit pumpkin patches. And by the end, we were just killing it with the pumpkin patch vote. And then you call the people on the losing campaign, and you say, so what happened? Why'd you lose? And it's oh, it was a horrible year to be a Democrat. And candidate sucks. She wouldn't raise any money. The issue environment was against us. And you realize, at its core, this was an industry that had very few tools to honestly attribute cause and effect, to honestly assign credit or blame. And into that space, people told stories, and some of them were plausible, and some of them were not, but that there wasn't a whole lot of authority behind them. And part of the problem is that campaigns are not designed to learn from their successes or their failures, and so they very rarely had sort of built in mechanisms that companies or other institutions have to do so. If you think about a candidate campaign, it's pretty much the worst company you can imagine, right? So it's going to exist for like 3 months or 6 months or, you know, in a craziest situation, 18 months. It's structured entirely with one goal, which is winning market share on some random Tuesday in November. The people who are effectively the chairman of the board, the candidate, is either somebody who's never done this before, in which case there's no good reason why, if you were a county commissioner running for Congress, you should have any idea how to oversee like a $2 million political marketing corporation, or they have done it before, in which case they think they know how to do it, and they might as well just keep on doing the same thing that worked last time with the same group of people. And because you're concerned with only with winning market share on one Tuesday, you don't hold out any money or time for research or development that'll tell you what worked or what didn't. The Wednesday after the election, when I'm calling around to my sources on campaigns to talk about what happened, you'd be shocked by how few of those people are having any sort of post-mortem conversation with their colleagues to rigorously go through what worked and what didn't. And they're on to their next races. The candidate is either very reasonably, if the candidate won, is on to running a transition or going back to work, or if the candidate lost, is on a beach somewhere feeling sorry for him or herself. And the consultants are pretty sure that they'll get work again, probably with the same group of people around some other candidate next year. And so you'd be shocked as well by how often the, you know, tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars of material, research material that was developed over the course of a campaign ends up in a dumpster the morning afterwards. There's just no desire to create an institutional memory in this field because nobody really stands to benefit from it. And so here campaign politics has been enriched by two innovations that came out of other fields but sort of almost accidentally penetrated the world of campaigns. The first of them, which I sort of write about in my book, is all the new data that's become available to campaigns in the last 10 to 15 years. You know, most of you probably know this, especially if you've taken a campaign management class, but you know, the basic set of data that campaigns work from is the information that people give when they register to vote. Your name, gender, age, in some states, race or ethnicity. If you have party registration, that's there. A record of the elections in which you voted, which is a pretty good indicator of how involved you are if you're particularly partisan, if you vote in primaries. Then your address, which starting in the 1960s or 70s with the sort of early advances in punch card computing, people organized these voter registration records and then were able to start matching up addresses with information about precinct vote history and from the census. So all of a sudden you can layer on information about your neighborhood, how your neighborhood votes, which is the lowest unit, which we know how people actually vote in a country with a secret ballot. But also information from the census that starts to give a sense of the sort of complexion of your neighborhood, race, ethnicity, socioeconomic status. And so into the late 1990s, campaigns use that set of data to start doing the basic work that they have to do, which is sorting through the electorate. Campaigns, as you'll learn if you haven't already written a campaign plan for the class, or you know, the crucial thing a campaign wants to do is decide which voters it wants to mobilize, how many voters and who they are they want to persuade. Most importantly, although people never really talk about this, at least in the media, is which voters you don't want to talk to because they're definitely going to vote for you, or they're very unlikely to vote at all, or they're never going to vote for you, and then figure out how to sort of triage the remaining voters and what type of interactions you want to have with them. And up until the 1990s, campaigns were working off of often a few dozen variables for each individual voter, the individual level stuff that was on a voter registration form, and then the sort of neighborhood level stuff about precinct political history or stuff from the census. It was at that point around 2000 that people in politics started looking at corporate marketers and saying, wow, these people know a whole lot more about the consumers that they're trying to reach than we do about the voters that we're trying to engage with. Starting in the 1950s, companies had begun developing these data warehouses, initially to develop credit rating scores, later used by direct mail marketers to figure out who should get catalogs, useful to charities that wanted to go out prospecting for new donors. And these eventually had hundreds of variables on each individual citizen in the United States, whether or not they were registered to vote. And it was stuff that was coming from aggregated from credit card companies or from customer phone surveys, but also a lot of very good individual level information that came when people filled out a customer service questionnaire or a warranty form or entered a sweepstakes, and you write down how many people live in your house and how many vacations you took last year and what your education level is. That becomes a really rich source of information about sort of the texture of the lives of voters that's not publicly available off of a registration form. And it became possible around 2000 with advances in computing power and changes in database architecture to link up the relatively thin records that political campaigns had used to profile the electorate with these really big data sets that existed in the private sector. And using statistical modeling techniques, you could look for patterns that were otherwise indiscernible to the naked eye. And, you know, at the core of this were are algorithms. And what an algorithm basically is a very long equation that's weighing the influence of a lot of different variables on answering one question. And the two questions that campaigns care most about when profiling voters are, how likely are you to cast a ballot this election, and how likely are you to support my candidate? And so now with hundreds of variables, these algorithms could weigh the individual influence that each of them had on predicting the outcome. And the results are a series of individualized predictions. They're packaged slightly different on the left than on the right, but the Obama campaign last year relied to sort through the electorate primarily on two what they called scores. This is 0 to 100 a percentage probability, what they called a turnout score, so the likelihood that you would cast a ballot in November, and then an Obama support score, a likelihood that you would, if asked, say, I support Obama over Romney. And then it's possible, basically, to predict any other yes or no question. You can create a pro-choice or pro-life score. You could predict the likelihood somebody owns a gun. You could predict the likelihood that they, answer, four out of five yeses on a series of questions about the environment. And all of a sudden what that did was it radically shifted the unit at which campaigns could sort through the electorate from big demographic categories like registered Republicans or people who vote in primaries or women between the ages of 25 and 40 who vote in Republican primaries down to individualized assessments where now a campaign, because they're sort of tracking the otherwise imperceptible relationship that all those variables have with one another, they can go out and go find the two people on a block whom they want to mobilize, the three people on that block whom they want to persuade, figure out among those three whom they want to persuade, which two are going to get their standard message about jobs and the economy, and which one's going to get a message about abortion. And I think one of the underappreciated reasons why Obama was able in 2008 and then in 2010 to expand the map into states like Virginia or North Carolina, where Democrats had not had a traditional map for victory in presidential elections, was that there was a basic math that Democrats had looked at where they would add up the number of votes in urban areas and in college towns and in some inner ring suburbs, and they'd see that it only got them to 44%, and so they'd look at it, the rest of the state where there were a lot of rural counties where they were getting 24% of the vote, and they say, well, we don't have a way to mobilize our strongholds and get to 50. All of a sudden, with this change at the level of targeting, you could go out to a county, if you were a Democrat, and say, okay, we only get 22% of the vote here, but if we can mobilize non-voting people who are on our side, we can take that up to 24% of the electorate, move towards a statewide vote goal that we want. And all of a sudden now, even if you're only going to win a quarter of the votes in the state, you can say, okay, there are 600 people in this county whom we want to mobilize, and there are 800 to whom we want to do targeted persuasion. And now it makes sense to go out and recruit and train some volunteers. And then it makes sense to have a staff field organizer out there to oversee them. And then it makes sense to invest in an office. And you don't need a traditional party organization, traditional structure there, but you can start to see the value of investing in a local operation. And so all of a sudden you have a better idea of which doors to knock on and which ones not to knock on. So then the question is, what do you do when you get there? And their politics has been aided by an innovation that came not from the private, from the corporate world, but from academia, from the social sciences. And I tell the story in my book about two political scientists at Yale, Don Green and Alan Gerber, who in 1998 decided to go out on the streets of New Haven and do this pretty radical thing for political scientists, which was to run a field experiment. Political science had lagged behind most of the other social sciences in doing real-world empirical field research, some of it for very good reasons, which are that people in politics don't want academics messing around with their campaigns, and some of it for sort of bad reasons, which is political science can be a very insular discipline, and people were very happy sort of making their way through large amounts of survey data that have been accumulated at great cost and running regressions and looking for patterns that way, but were really attached from actually interacting with politics in the real world or trying to do things that would empirically measure the effectiveness of campaigns. And so these guys, Green and Gerber, sort of stumbled into this because they initially wanted to sort of get engaged in some theoretical debates in their field. But they had the idea that they would go out and run an experiment to see if they could change somebody's likelihood of voting. There was a sort of predominant theory informed by economics that shaped a lot of the way that people thought of political behavior, known as rational choice theory. And the idea was that people and institutions make a series of rational decisions. And one of their questions was, why do people vote? This doesn't seem that rational. Not just for whom do you vote, but most of the time your vote does not make a difference. Seems like if you run a cost-benefit equation, which is the way that rational choice people think about it, the cost of voting, not just going to a polling place and waiting, but the cost of learning about the candidates and preparing yourself to vote, almost always outweigh the benefits, which would be the likelihood that your one vote will make the difference in some pivotal election in some way that'll yield some result that betters your life. And it seemed particularly crazy to them that on a Tuesday morning, everybody is going through this calculation in their head while deciding why not to vote or why to vote. And yet 55% of Americans are voting in presidential elections. And so they thought, well, let's run an experiment. If we could change individuals' likelihoods of voting through small interactions, we can say, wow, maybe something else is going on here. So they partnered with a local League of Women Voters chapter in Connecticut. And they went out in the streets of New Haven before the 1998 midterm elections, and they designed something that looked a lot like a drug trial. They randomly assigned voters to one of four groups, and the same way that a pharmaceutical trial would, except instead of randomly assigning people to get drugs and placebos, they got different types of political communication. So a quarter of the voters got a nonpartisan pre-election get-out-the-vote reminder by mail. It was a postcard. A quarter of them got a phone call, which is from a phone bank, a paid call center in Omaha. A quarter of them got an in-person visit from a canvasser. It was mostly grad students. And then a quarter of them were in a control group, and they got nothing. And afterwards, you can go to the Board of Elections, and you could see who voted and who didn't. And it turns out that the people who got the phone call saw no increase in their rate of voting. The people who got the mail saw a small but appreciable increase in the rate of voting. The people who got the in-person visit had a massive boost. Gerber and Green could not get this finding published in any academic journals at first. I think in my book I describe their breakthroughs, an embarrassingly practical insight. But it quickly got noticed by people who work in politics, most of whom do not spend their time reading academic journals, regardless. And there tended to be one of two types of responses to this paper among the sort of political consultants who saw it. One was, oh, great, academics have developed a scientifically credible tool for empirically disentangling cause and effect and assessing the relative effectiveness of these things that we encourage candidates to spend, you know, millions of dollars on every year. And then there was another response, probably more prevalent, which was, you know, oh no, academics have developed a scientifically credible tool to determine whether these things that we convince candidates to spend millions of dollars on actually work. And all of a sudden you had these, like, sort of small intramural battles where, you know, mail vendors would send a copy of this journal article as it was eventually published out to say you should, you know, give us some of the phone budget, and or you know, the people running the field operation would say you shouldn't spend all this money on robocalls, you should put it into field. But there was a small group of political consultants, mostly on the left, who saw sort of greater purpose in this type of research. And they said, if these academics are using sort of scientifically credible tools to measure the effectiveness of these things we do, we should be paying attention to their research. And hey, we're out doing campaigns every year and spending a lot of money on them. Why don't we start running our own experiments? And so you started in the years after 2000, beginning with these guys at Yale, and they're grad students and increasingly sort of a diaspora of political scientists running election experiments, sometimes with collaborators in campaigns and parties especially the sort of institutional groups on the left, organized labor, the women's groups, the environmental groups, going out and running all these experiments. And at the beginning, a lot of them were measuring basically the comparative effectiveness. So we know that mail is better than phones. Well, what about is two phone calls any better than one phone call? And if should the last piece of mail arrive on the Thursday before the election or the Friday before the election? And does it work in Korean? And does it work in rural areas? And like after 5 or 6 years, basically they had measured every version of like comparative effectiveness of individually targetable voter contact methods. And it was pretty clear time and time again that the best way to mode for mobilizing a voter was basically a high quality interaction face-to-face at a door with a trained volunteer. We learned certain things don't work. We've learned now from dozens, if not hundreds, of experiments that robocalls have no impact on turnout in any context. Then the sort of shift starting in around 2004 was to ask another set of questions. And there I write about how a guy named Todd Rogers stumbled onto the scene. And he was a graduate student at Harvard studying behavioral psychology. And on the side, he would volunteer for campaigns. He was a Democrat. And in the fall of 2003, he would go up to New Hampshire on the weekends to volunteer for Wesley Clark during the presidential primary. And he'd go to these field offices, and he'd hear people making phone calls, reading from a script, what was a very routine sort of standard bit of language at the time that had a particular amount of emotional salience to Democrats now a few years after the 2000 election, which obviously had been so close in Florida. And they'd say something like, you know, there are so many million Americans that did not exercise their right to vote in the last election. Imagine how things would be different if they had all turned out to vote. Don't be part of this problem of low civic participation. Go out and vote. And, you know, Democrats all over the country, many Republicans have been putting language like this in their scripts for years without ever thinking about it. It's a very sort of League of Women Voters, civic-minded message. But to Todd Rogers, it sounded a lot like begging people to be part of a very sad, lonely cause. And he knew that there was a pretty rich experimental literature in behavioral psychology that suggested that you can increase somebody's likelihood of doing something just by making it sound popular. And he thought back to a sort of classic experiment that had been done in the 1980s by a psychologist named Robert Cialdini, who had partnered with a hotel chain that wanted to increase guests' rate of reusing their towels. So hotels don't want to clean your towels every day because it costs them a lot of money in detergent. It takes longer for housekeeping to turn over a room. And for a while, they'd put little sign in the bathroom that said something like, every time you wash your towels, it wastes so many gallons of water. Don't be part of this ecological nightmare. Reuse their towels. And Cialdini designed an experiment where he randomly assigned some rooms to get a little placard that would go on the sink that said, most guests who stay in this room reuse their towels every day. And just by giving people that small cue at a moment where they had a very low cost decision to make, basically whether throw their towel on the floor or put it up on the rack, you change people's behavior, and people recycle their reuse their towels several points higher in the rooms that got randomly assigned this message. So Rogers designed an experiment where before an election, this in Kentucky in 2005 and in New Jersey, where voters would hear one of two scripts in a phone call, a nonpartisan get out the vote call before the weekend before the elections. Both of them had an underlying set of facts that were true and accurate. Basically, because of population growth, you can make any election sound either, you know, ridiculously overattended or like tragically undersubscribed. And so half of the people in the would be in a sample that heard something like fewer voters, more voters participate in the last election for governor of New Jersey than any other election in the state's history. We expect long lines at the polls next Tuesday. Come out and vote. And the other half heard voter participation rates were lower in the last election for governor of New Jersey than any other election in the state's history. Don't be part of this problem of low participation. Go out and vote. And it turned out the people who got what they called the high turnout message, the one that emphasized how popular voting was, turned out several points higher. And this was a really big breakthrough because Rogers demonstrated that you could change somebody's likelihood of voting, of participating in this sort of fundamental political act, not by telling them anything about the candidates or the parties or the issues or the consequences of a change in power, one side being in control of a governor's mansion or not. In fact, if you look at that message, it really has nothing that we would consider traditional campaign messaging. Really what he was doing wasn't talking about the candidates. He was talking to voters about themselves and their desire to fit in, their desire to do what their neighbors were doing. And it opened up a whole lot of other research questions, many of them informed by other findings from behavioral science that had been proven by in fields other than politics, been proven in economics or in psychology or in lab tests, but had never really been tested in the world of elections. And pretty soon we came to understand that there are a lot of ways to influence somebody's likelihood of voting that were all about this idea of sort of fitting in and letting voters understand that you could change how they see themselves or how they're seen. And so what we now know is the sort of best tool for turning a non-voter into a voter was demonstrated in this experiment that was run in Michigan in the summer of 2006, where the two guys from Yale partnered with a local direct mail vendor in East Lansing, and they sent voters a series of letters, one of which said something like, "Dear Sasha, your history as a voter is a publicly available document on file with the Salt Lake County Board of Elections. Here is your history as a voter. You did not vote in last year's county council election. You did vote in the presidential election. You did not vote in the presidential primary. You did vote in the school board election. And here are your neighbors' vote histories." And had other people from your block and whether or not they had showed up to vote in those same elections. And then there was a threat. There's another election coming up, and afterwards we'll send everybody an updated set. This increased turnout among the people who received it by 28%. It also got the guy who sent it death threats. And both of these facts helped to convince the academics behind the experiment that they were onto something pretty potent, which is this idea that psychologists call social pressure, letting people know that in this case, it's something that they do that they probably thought of as a purely private act because we have a secret ballot. Nobody knows how you vote. But whether or not you vote is easily available. Campaigns have been using it basically forever. Letting them know that that's actually public and that they can be sort of judged or surveilled or compared to their peers over it. And it turns out that that's a major driver towards getting people to change their behavior. And so I think real big difference between where the parties are now in 2013 is I can't tell you how many times last year I was out covering the campaign, and I would hear from Republicans I knew either on the Romney campaign, you know, sources, subjects of mine, on the Romney campaign or at the RNC in Washington, who would get upset because journalists were kept on writing that, you know, Obama has 140 field offices in Ohio and Romney only has 42. And, you know, my Republican sources would say, like, you're not going to fall for this. And, you know, the, like, field offices don't vote. I heard that a lot. It's just true. Field offices do not vote. This is a constitutional fact. But I actually think that they sort of believed what they were saying, which was they thought that Obama's campaign went out and signed a whole bunch of leases on vacant retail spaces to make their volunteers feel good or to get good media coverage, because still, by and large, in Republican campaigns across the country, Republicans see individual interactions with voters as something you do for media coverage or to keep your volunteers busy, or to make the party loyalists feel like you're doing something in their neighborhood. Democrats have realized, based on, you know, and this is true now very widely in the culture of Democratic campaigns, all the way up to the sort of highest rungs of the Obama reelect and the Democratic committees last year and most of their allies, that there's now a very rich body of evidence that suggests that you can change an individual's likelihood of voting by having kind of high-quality interactions with them, almost all of them not about the candidate or the issues, but about the voters and about changing their sense of place and how they fit into all this. And so I think as people try to ask the big question about last year, which is, you know, how did a president with a fairly not good economy who was weak in all sorts of ways encourage core parts of his constituency to vote at equal, if not higher rates than they did 4 years earlier when, by all accounts, they had far more reason to be enthusiastic about him. I think about a conversation I had in Chicago. I flew out 2 days after the election for a post-election piece I was doing and met with a bunch of my sources on the Obama campaign. I talked with somebody fairly senior about one of the things that had really separated, I think, how the Romney sort of high command saw the electorate and how the Obama campaign saw the electorate. That the Romney folks were looking at sort of, you know, you go and you take a poll, and one of the essential questions in a poll is figuring out who among the people you talk to or could talk to are likely to be voters or not, right? And the Romney people are incredibly dependent on measuring the self-reported enthusiasm of voters. How enthusiastic are you about voting in the election? And if you said you were, like, from 7 to 10 on a scale of 10, then they thought you were pretty enthusiastic and you were likely to vote if you say you voted in other elections. And if you said less than that, they kicked you off the call or didn't count, you know, counted you in a broader universe, but not in the sort of likely voter model that they had. And so I was talking through this with the Obama campaign guy, this idea of enthusiasm and its sort of place in our politics. And he said, go call people and ask them if they're enthusiastic about going to the dentist. Nobody will say yes. But a lot of people go to the dentist. And some of them are just people who go to the dentist every year because they can and they do, and it's a matter of routine. And some of them are people who have a dental hygienist who's really good about calling you and badgering you to go or setting the postcard reminders or following up. And the sort of point was that people develop habits and behaviors that are not affected by enthusiasm or by what we think of as traditional political messaging. And the we now have a fairly rich body of incredibly convincing scientific work that suggests that this is as relevant when it comes to voting as it is in other parts of human life. And campaigns finally have the tools to target those interactions in a really granular way so that they know that they're having those interactions with people where they can make a difference and where the difference will produce votes in the direction which they want them. And so I think that the smartest people in campaigns, regardless of what their jobs are now thinking in that mode of this being about lots of little things and figuring out how to, in an intelligent way, structure those interactions so that, in many cases, voting becomes something meaningful in people's lives, becomes part of their lives, even if the candidates or the parties these days aren't giving them a whole lot of reasons to be enthusiastic. So I'll thank you and take questions.
If you have a question, can you just stand up, tell about your name and a little bit about yourself?
My name is Brian Smith. I'm a senior in political science here at the U. Face-to-face interactions are definitely one of the most expensive activities a campaign can do. Can you touch on how fundraising efforts have correlated with the campaigns and their increased effort to get face-to-face interactions and maybe super PACs interactions on, you know, the presidential level?
Sure. So on one level, you know, so what we know, right, is volunteer interactions, both on the phones or at the door, are better than paid. So a volunteer phone bank is more effective at mobilizing voters than a paid call center. Volunteer canvassers are more effective at mobilizing non-voters than paid canvassers. There are places where, so on some level that's free labor, but it's free labor that requires a lot of infrastructure, offices, staff to recruit and train people to do it well. So it's on one level, it's the cheapest type of interaction you can have, but on another level, it requires a lot of planning. So, you know, one of the things that's worth thinking about is campaigns. There are a lot of campaigns that spend money in ways that they may know is inefficient just because they don't have options to spend it more efficiently. So I said that robocalls we know do nothing for turnout. And I think we have reason to be skeptical. They do a whole lot for persuasion in most cases either. But yet, people still do a lot of robocalls the weekend before the election. Why? Well, in some cases, it's because a phone vendor is making money and convinces the campaign manager, who's never seen any of the academic research, that it works. But part of it is also, like, let's say you're a campaign and it's the Friday before the election and you have budgeted everything out to the last dime and you've bought your TV and radio for the final weekend and you've printed every last yard sign you're going to print, and your finance director comes to you and says, I just got another $10,000 check from our big donor. Great. So now you say, okay, I have $10,000, it's the Friday before the election, what can I do? Well, it's probably too late to cut a new TV ad. If you're in a competitive media market, all the TV you'd want to buy is already bought. It's too late to get a new piece of mail out before Tuesday. It's too late to open a field office and hire staff to develop and train, recruit new volunteers. It may be too late to go out and hire even a paid canvassing firm to bus people in from another state and pay them $12 an hour to knock on doors. But you can always, like, put the candidate in a hotel room and have them record a robocall and dump basically an infinite number of them onto unsuspecting voters as late as, like, Monday at 8 p.m. And so what you do see is a narrowing of ways to intelligently spend money over the course of a campaign, even if you do know that one way is better than the other. And field is not just costly, but takes the longest build up. And so one of the we don't spend enough time, I think, talking about the ways that presidential reelection campaigns are just radically different than everything else that exists in politics. And one reason that the Bush campaign in 2004 was a big innovator in sort of the first generation of you know, what we call micro-targeting techniques, and another reason why the Obama campaign, I think, was able to innovate so much and develop such an efficient, sophisticated mobilization effort was that they effectively are a four-year enterprise. They're going at full steam for like 18 months. You're able to plan and budget out. It's the only time that a political campaign can start to think like a corporation. And so one of the long-term sort of overhead costs is building out a field operation to sustain the free volunteer contact. Now, so that's irreplaceable. at its core, you need volunteers. That's a place where I think enthusiasm still matters. You know, I think we overstate the importance of enthusiasm as a driver to voting. I still think there's reason to think of enthusiasm as a driver for people who already support you to give money or give more money or to give time or give more time. And so it's worth thinking about what types of institutions can take advantage of volunteers. And I think there's a good reason to be skeptical that super PACs should be in that business at all, because I don't know anybody that says, I want to go give my Saturday over for a super PAC. You know, there are people volunteer for candidates, people who are part of, especially on a regular basis, involved in their local county or state party, get involved in party politics. There's some long-term issue groups that have, you know, whether it's the NRA or the League of Conservation Voters, where people are very much attached, membership-based groups where people will volunteer for them. It's very hard for especially the current nature of the kind of faceless, intentionally faceless super PAC, I think, to build the type of long-term institution where people want to work for free. So I think the question is not that every, or the proposition isn't that just because we know that sort of this high-quality face-to-face interaction with volunteers is the best way to mobilize voters, and we're starting to get reason to believe that you can do persuasion intelligently that way too. But that doesn't mean that it's the most efficient way for everybody to do something, which is to say there are a lot of super PACs that would spend hundreds of millions of dollars to recruit one volunteer, right? And the marginal cost of the interaction that one volunteer would have would never justify it. And maybe it is smarter for them to just send a lot of mail, which we know has still some effect on mobilizing people. So I do think that there are a lot of ways in which I think people can sort of overlearn some of the lessons in my book. And one of them is to say, okay, well, this is the gold standard. It worked for Obama. Everybody needs to do that. It's like, no. You have a certain amount of resources. You have a certain tactical strategic objective. Start thinking about what the most efficient way that you can spend the resources you have and the time that you have to get the outcome you want. And it'll be different for different campaigns with different types of supporters in different places, different amounts of time, different budgets.
Hi, my name is Jefferson. I'm a senior here at the university. My question for you is, you talked a lot about how in order to get or to increase voter turnout for a candidate, you should encourage voters to say that this is something that a lot of people are doing rather than saying we desperately need your vote. Does this also translate to like city council, mayor races, or state legislature races? And if not, what is the best way to increase voter turnout for those races as well?
Sure. So people have replicated a version of this in a lot of different settings. And like a lot of the research that comes out of sort of behavioral psychology, behavioral sciences generally, the idea is that the mechanism is pretty universal. That in this case, this idea of social pressure, sort of desire to fit in, is something that is... And we have, you know, some good experimental evidence that it's not just that it works at different types of elections, but it works for men as comparably as it does for women. It works across racial and ethnic lines, across age lines. We're not seeing a whole lot of differences. And I think the idea is that it's a fairly, like, universal instinct that people have that's relevant in ways that's detached from politics but can be applied to politics. I think it's probably harder... You know, on one end, if you're going to, you're in a really low turnout environment, it's probably a lot easier to dramatically change the electorate through turnout. But you're still, the behavioral hurdles are still pretty high, which is, you know, we have reason to believe voting is a habit. I think some of it's probably information based, which is, you know, where to vote and how to vote. And voting in a presidential election often is kind of different than voting in a low turnout municipal election, which is a lot of the cues you're getting. You're walking down the street, you're not seeing the same number of signs, your neighbors aren't talking about the same way. So you could imagine a sort of paradigm where it's like a different type of habit to vote in something that you think of as a sort of, it's a little bit like, you know, there are a lot of people who probably watch the Super Bowl as a matter of habit because it's hard to like not realize that the Super Bowl's on, right? But they're probably, like, not a lot of people who watch, Like, if you watch the Pro Bowl, it's because, like, you want to watch the Pro Bowl. Like, you know the Pro Bowl's on. You know what channel it's on, right? And so it's worth thinking about the types of people as different types of people, but I still think that probably creating a sense of social interaction around that is important. You know, one experiment I'll describe that did have different disparate impacts, but that are, it's kind of behavioral, is so one experiment that Todd Rogers ran before the presidential primary in Pennsylvania in the spring of 2008, randomly assigned voters to get a phone call, nonpartisan get out the vote reminder the weekend before the election, and this was, you know, another one of those like Omaha call centers. The person said, "Do you plan to vote on Tuesday?" And if the voter said yes, said, "What time do you plan to vote? What will you be doing beforehand, and how will you get to your polling place?" And the caller actually never wrote down the answers to that question, but you'd say, "Yeah, I guess I'll vote like in the morning, like 8 a.m. I guess I'll be, have dropped the kids off from school, so I'll be driving." They didn't write the answers down, but the whole point was to do what psychologists call plan making or implementation intentions. And this has been demonstrated in other areas than politics, and they were translating it for the first time. But the idea is that if you rehearse an activity in advance, you sort of visualize yourself doing it and go through the steps, you're more likely to actually follow through on it. And so it turns out that the people who went through this exercise voted several points higher than the people who didn't. Fine. They went back afterwards, and because now a lot more data was available about the individual voters, this was in 2008, than there had been when those first experiments in New Haven were done in 1998, they were able to see which types of people responded more to this. And it turns out that while like the general population was an increase of 2 to 3 points, the people who lived in what were classified as single-person households were 10 points more likely to vote after having had that interaction. And the conclusion that the experimenters drew, which is like entirely plausible, is that if you live with somebody, if you live with a spouse or a roommate or a relative, you're probably already conditioned to think about voting as a sort of collaborative act that requires planning. So you already beforehand say like, "Oh, honey, I'm going to drop the kids off at school, so you should probably vote in the morning. And you know, if you vote in the evening, then I'll run the errands or whatever." But if you live alone, as I do, like, you know, you basically improvise everything. Like, I don't need to make arrangements before I go shopping or whatever. And so, but so in this moment, for entirely inadvertently, this anonymous person at a call center was fulfilling the role in somebody's life that a spouse or a relative or a boyfriend would, helping somebody develop a plan that they wouldn't. So you've now changed somebody's behavior. It's different based on their demographic attributes, but not because really about their demographic attributes. It's because those are habits or behaviors that wouldn't exist in their lives otherwise. Thank you.
On behalf of the Hinckley Institute of Politics, we'd like to thank Sasha Eisenberg for giving us an excellent informative forum.
Thanks. Thank you.
You're welcome to take questions if you want.
Oh, sure.